bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. And today we have a very special episode. I always get excited when people reach out to me to talk to people they know that they think are going to be good episodes. And an old friend who I haven't physically seen probably in 20 years, but you know, we're friends on social media, and reaches out to me and says, "Hey, I'm living here in the islands and I have someone I think would be very interesting for you to talk to." And I think when I say words like fascinated, it could be a little belittling. I'm enraged at the lack of information we have in this country about some of the modern atrocities that we have committed, and one of which happened in my lifetime. I was a school-age child when the U.S. invaded Grenada, and the anniversary of that deadly invasion was just a few weeks ago. October 25th. So on to talk with me today about the history of the revolution in Grenada and why Ronald Reagan even bothered to deal with this small, tiny island nation is Milton J. Coy, award-winning journalist, human rights activist, and community activist. Mr. Milton J. Coy, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jason. It is certainly an opportunity to share with you and to share with your audience information regarding the Grenada Revolution. It is still something that is in our minds and the mouths, the minds of people. Certainly, there are a lot of people who would have lived through it. Was involved at some level, but whatever it might have been at that time, we still haven't gotten over it. It's some 37 years ago, but it's still raw, I like to say raw, in our memories, in our minds. And for some, it's in the experience. I mean, you know, things happen to us when we during our lives, and we remember those things. We keep those things as part of the experience that we have, in life. So yeah, it's my pleasure to share.
Now, I think it's a great. It's easier to understand these things when you explain why, and easily I can ask you what happened, and you can tell me, and we can go over the what happened afterwards. But I think what's really interesting is why was there even a need for the revolution that happened, and I think we have to first talk about and you don't have to expound about it too long, but can you explain what Grenada was like before?
So
before even the revolution happens, like what the dictatorship that's kind of going on at that time?
Okay, my pleasure. The revolution took place, occurred on March 13th, 1979. And that revolution is referred to as, in several places, as a glorious revolution. Meaning that we would have been given an opportunity to correct all the wrongs that we saw that was happening. The government of the day, that was in 1979, was headed by Eric Matthew Gerry. He's ruled the country for several years and has been, through his actions, been considered to be bordering, and I'm trying to be cautious here and mild here, bordering on dictatorialism.
Gotcha.
Yes. There was great hunger, there was great inequality, there was human rights abuses, people were picked up and beaten and sent to prison. In fact, the people who headed the revolution, Maurice Bishop and the other colleagues, They formed themselves into an alliance, several progressive organizations coming forward together, and they formed the New Jewel Movement, NJM. And so they had information that Eric Gehry, the prime minister, was leaving the country to go to the USA to attend some international forum. And while he was away, they mounted the takeover, and they were able to, succeed, because Gehry was not able to return back to the island until after. And so it was a fight, a struggle for, for food, a struggle and a fight for justice, a struggle and a fight to rid ourselves of all the inequalities that were taking place. So on March 13th, 1979, the morning of March 13th, they stormed the radio stations, they got control of several of the police stations, and by midday, afternoon of the following day, they had flags hoisted, in terms of surrender. And we were able to build on that, and so there was this jubilation that at least we were out of that. Now, it was that revolution is the first revolution in the English speaking Caribbean, and so it was new to everybody. People don't know what to expect. Of course, within the context of those times, it was 1979 in the 70s. And so the new government really went on and formed alliances with Marxist Leninist countries.
Cuba and Russia, right?
And Russia, right. But I must make the point here that even after that, before that, when the revolution occurred, the U.S. government, of course, did not want that to happen, but they made a minimal, when Prime Minister Maurice Bishop made a request for assistance and support, he was only able to say, well, we can give you $5,000. But of course, it wasn't genuine, in my view, wanting to help. And so the revolutionaries leaned heavily on Cuba, Russia, and the Eastern Bloc, basically. Around that time, we had the non-alignment movement. I don't know if you're aware, but it's a movement that, as the name says, non-alignment. So they weren't aligned to the East or to the West. That's in theory, though. But they had support from the East. Thereafter, the revolution started to grow. Things were happening. It was a revolution for better health care. It was a revolution for better education. And a revolution also that focused on people, building the people's, building their capacity and so on. So that's basically, what really happened during the next few days, few weeks of the revolution from 1979. Of course, when that happened, there was a lot of euphoria in some places, and there were a lot of concerns because, as I said, this is the first search in the English-speaking Caribbean. So we had to walk on a tightrope, as it were, and to see how we can defend the revolution. Because from the day one and from the first week, USA started to threaten put pressure. And it eventually, the pressure, reached to a head, just after a couple of years. And as a result of the pressure, there was the invasion. And we'll talk about the invasion, but what led to the invasion is another thing that we need to speak about, because for many historians and people who have been involved, the invasion was something planned a long time. In my view, yeah. I would think it was something that planned from day one. And they have effectively gotten it and created chaos within the government itself. You know, people, they influence people, and there were all kinds of views. And you know, I must also say that it wasn't necessarily a time when, you know, the revolution is a revolution. And obviously, they would want to protect the revolution. So it was very much a case where people, you know, were scared. Some people were very actually arrested for what we refer to in those times as counter-revolutionaries. You know, was trying to turn back the revolution. And so that gave them opening. And what is the that I'm referring to? Where people were arrested for doing things contrary to the revolution. And as a revolution, of course, you have to take some tough stands because your enemy is real. When you have an enemy as the United States, always on your back, trying to get you to crash, you know, that is it. That is a state where you always have to be on your P's and Q's. So the invasion came. The invasion came because there was this split within the revolution itself, the leadership. And the split was really, from what I know and what I've experienced, it is really the time when the leadership felt that so many things wrong was taking place within the revolution, the leadership of the revolution. And there was a time when people became so concerned about activities of people, members of the government, that they had to, what I refer to, call an urgent meeting to discuss the way going forward. How can we deal with this? Because this is a revolution. It's not something that is, you know, that people really go to the polls and vote, etc. But it is what overthrow. And that was, I would say that was something that we had to face. Always be on our guard. Always be watching out. Always be looking out. Now, one of the things that the revolution did was to immediately mount an army. It's called the People's Revolutionary Army, PRA. Of course, the reason, of course, one would understand to defend yourself because there was always threat of invasion, as well as there was a militia. Militia, of course, would be dealing with the people. So in the communities, they would be training people, not necessarily at the level of an army, but of course, helping them to understand the basics and when and if anything would happen, they would understand and they would know exactly how to respond.
Now, from what I know, and I don't know that much about Grenada, there was huge advancements during the Maurice Bishop, the short time that he was there, in like literacy. And I think it was the first time there was affordable housing built, basically trying to get the economy right. Because I think when his government took it over, it was something like only $24 in the government coffers. Like it was just kind of raided by the previous regime. So there was a lot of work to do that happened in a short amount of time, it seems like.
Yes, there was. And, you know, as I said, one of the things that the revolution stood for and fought for is to get rid of corruption. I mean, not have used the word corruption earlier on, but really and truly, the human rights abuses, the lack of proper healthcare system. I mean, everything was shattered. So corruption was definitely a part of it. And so they have moved swiftly within about 4.5 years, were able to accomplish quite a number of things. Now, Grenada became the envy of the region because of its improved healthcare system. You know, having been aligned to Cuba, Cuba, you know, gave us doctors and nurses and medical equipment and trained our people. And they gave us some very, very, very good platforms for which we can build upon. So healthcare was something noticeable during the revolutionary period.
And literacy too, right? I know the literacy rate skyrocketed.
Literacy too. We had this program called adult education. So you have people who may not have been able to read and write, but functional, were taught. And imagine seeing a teenager teaching someone who is 50 and 60 or 70 years the basics. That was a sight to understand. So literacy was given much attention. Development generally in all aspects. They established cooperatives, bringing people together to provide that kind of employment and development. So that was a big thing. Housing, you mentioned that for the first time, but we've now been, because it existed during the what I refer to as the Gary era. There were housing built, but of course, because of the existence of corruption, it was not equitable. Were not given. The people who needed to have these houses, most of them, in my view, weren't given. It was more of a partisan. So if I know you, your friends, etc. But housing, housing was a critical thing, in a time. And so these are my things. I mean, I'm not really exhausted all the things that happened, Julian. But I'm here. You know, it was on a trajectory that was moving upward and positive. People, even now, we're still feeling the effects of those positive things. In fact, I might want to go as far as to say, at present, we may have about 75% of our medical practitioners were trained in Cuba. So you see how that era contributed towards what we have now, which is not compared to what was then. But of course, our people had the opportunity to go to go into medicine. I mean, in this part of the world, it's costly. And when you have the opportunity, to go and to accomplish those dreams that you have, I think it is positive. So it created a platform where development can take place in a genuine way, not just in saying that we're developing, but in a genuine way.
Now, I know that at the time, and I don't know if there's anything different being grown there, but I think a lot of nutmeg comes from Grenada, and like a few other spices I can't think of off the top of my head. But before Maurice Bishop comes into power, the country is still importing most of its food, yes. Right?
Yes.
And during his administration, doesn't that get reversed?
Yes, in fact, one of the slogans, and even today people still refer to the slogan, eat what you grow and grow what you eat.
We need to feed. Beautiful.
We need to feed ourselves. And that's where the cooperatives come in. Cooperatives brought young people together in farms and all kinds of farming. So they were able to work for themselves. They were able to, of course, they were given the kind of training and assistance in organizing and managing and so on. So it was a very important part where the people experience self sustainability in the sense that we can feed ourselves. We can look after our own interests.
And I think that's so important. And this is kind of the main thing for me of why it got me into reading Marx and even Lenin is because, and I don't know if you read Marx or Lenin and I'm not going to judge you if you do or you don't, but, but again, very similar to Burkina Faso in Africa, it's the same thing where you become beholden to IMF loans, International Monetary Fund loans, mm-hmm. and you become beholden to the West for the most part. Mm-hmm. So when you see governments like Cuba and even Venezuela during the Bolivarian Revolution, constantly, like truly helping people out, be self-sufficient.
Yes.
It's not, I want to indebt you forever so I can constantly take your resources. It's a real feeling of alliance. And, yeah. and we're also seeing it with China and the Belt and Road Initiative over there and what they're doing in Africa. And I think from an American lens, we just don't understand. And I'm talking about rank and file Americans, not politicians. We don't understand that, that comradeship. That other nations can have with one another, especially the island nations during that time, because you know I think we forget around the same time that you know Grenada is trying to come up, Nicaragua is dealing with U.S. yeah. backed death squads, and it's getting into El Salvador, Jamaica's having their problems across the water.
Yes.
You know, so it's this tumultuous time, and it almost feels like, you know, again, hindsight's so 2020. It feels like that you might have even wanted to keep the good things you're doing quiet so the U.S. wouldn't see.
Well, I think it might have been impossible to keep it quiet because the things were positive, and while they were. Lots of shouts and cries on the other side for you know people mm-hmm. being arrested and so on. We couldn't keep this quiet because people were benefiting, as mm-hmm. I said, and noticeable. I think that the opportunities given to our young people for training, for going into all kind of we have accountants, we have engineers, and all these things were provided by these friendly countries at the time. So we had a constant flow of young people going to get training, return back, and sell the country. Unfortunately, most of them have not been able to return before the revolution ended. But they returned nonetheless, and the country benefited, even now is benefiting from their experience and expertise, really. So we had to speak out. We had to... let people know, because speaking out was one of the things that would help us to, I saw it then as transparency. So people would see exactly what you're doing and understand that these big guns are trying to shoot you down. You know, so when you cry out, you're just crying out in vain. You are showing real examples, real evidence of how they're doing and what they're doing to make life difficult for the people.
So basically, you know, we have this nation that's impoverished, right? Grenada was a slave colony.
Yes.
Is it still part of the Commonwealth of the UK?
Yes, it's the Commonwealth. Even after we would have received our independence in 1974, which I want to make a comment on. I mean, Eric Gehry, who led us into independence, I mean, even that alone was in itself tumultuous. There were blackouts. Because, you see, it was felt then that he wanted to go into independence so that he can have more freeway to what he wanted and to engage in alleged corruptions, you know? So there was protest. But however, it happened. I mean, not because we wanted to be independent as a people, but I guess because the British felt, listen, it's time that these colonies go on their own. So it was easy to just say, okay, you know, independence is granted, per se, etc. But although that was done, they gave us a constitution that they wrote for us so that they could still keep us under check. So yes, Grenada is still part of the Commonwealth we participate in several of these international forums, really.
So slave colony, mm-hmm. part of the Commonwealth,
yes,
has a revolution,
yes,
starts to uplift the people, right? Is it a revolution of the proletariat, as Marx would say? And it's and we're lifting up the people, right, bottom up, not like we do here in the U.S. where it's give billionaires a lot of money and hope that it trickles down. So we're doing it the other way, and we're actually seeing improvements in the people's lives. And an airport gets built.
Correct. And
I'm sorry.
Talking about the airport. Well, you know, the enemy, America, felt that this airport was not what it says it was for. Oh, they claimed that, listen, this is another satellite station. And it was the Cubans, the Russians who were building this so that they can have easy access. And the Cuban really actually labor provided that kind of support. They didn't give us support in building that. People who is trying to, you know, develop itself. And with the understanding that as our agricultural producing nation, we need to have the ways and means to ship our goods and to sell it elsewhere.
of course.
Yeah, so it was necessary that an airport, an international airport, in fact, I mean, it can be seen now that international airport, some people who were involved in the revolution at the time and are still in, and are now from the way in government in the current day, they have got ahead and changed the name of the airport, and the airport is now called the Maurice Bishop International Airport, again reflecting the contribution, the value, the importance of what the airport means to the economy and to the people. So it was necessary that we have this airport. And as I said, it was named a few years ago. It was named after, it was named the Maurice Bishop International Airport. And what is interesting is that although the U.S. opposed the building of the airport, when the revolution collapsed, they came in and took over and said, "No, we'll finish it up for you." They assisted him completely because at the time it happened, the revolution collapsed. It was still in progress, you know. So the same
airport. I didn't know that. I thought it was finished. I didn't know that they were still building it.
No, so the same airport that they condemned and say it is a base,
for Russians and Cubans.
That same airport, they came in and, of course, took control. All they wanted was control of everything. It's now several years later, recognizing the contributions and value and importance of what it is to the people, it was renamed the Maurice Bishop International. And I think that is there, is there, so the world can say, listen, we remember Maurice Bishop International. We remember Maurice Bishop and naming this airport after him after all his struggles and with the assistance and support from Cuba. I mean, Cuban workers just came in thousands and just, because, you know, Cuba is an internationalist country and they go all over the world to help build people, to help healthcare system, whatever it is, they have this. And I think it's a very noble thing on their behalf from their standpoint. Mm-hmm. And they can help people. They're not just coming to take from you, but they are empowering you. I mean, whatever one might say is the ulterior motive. The people are being benefited. So Cuba did a lot. Russia and all these Czechoslovakia and all these all these states in the East, the Eastern Bloc, they really supported and lent a helping hand at that time of our growth and development. You know.
No, it's I was watching a documentary from the 80s. It actually happened before the invasion, the U.S. invasion, but it was done in 1983. And it actually talked about the airport And then I've seen other documentaries about, and actually, if anybody wants to hear it, and I'll probably put a link in it to the in this episode,
okay.
There's clips of Reagan actually talking about the airport as if it's this horrible plot to destroy America.
Yeah.
And apparently he is known to have said, and I don't even think this is like one of those things that some say, it's written somewhere, and I'll try to find it, where he said we got to get the taste of Vietnam out of our mouth for Americans, and he picked this small island nation of like 100,000 people, which he deemed to be the next Cuba, a very peaceful island nation that, from my understanding, did not have a large military, if at all. Like you said, there's like a small militia just to teach people how to fight, and that's not gonna take over a nation of 300 million people with the largest military the world's ever known anytime soon.
But I also think that it's important to note that despite the disparity in sizes, I think that it showed a commitment and resilience. I mean, we knew the power that we have, but of course, if the people are empowered and the people could resist, you not only, we can only say that we will only defend militarily, but if the people are educated, and I think that's where the issue, the importance of education comes in. Mm-hmm. Where if you educate the people, that's a powerful tool, and that was happening, but of course the propaganda infiltrated several groups and sections of the society, and it created, resistance and all kinds of problems per se. But I think it's important that we understand, that the people, we were resolute to stand up for our country, notwithstanding the size. I mean, who would want to fight like a giant and a
and it's not like Grenada was trying to fight. That's the thing. Oh. It wasn't like there were you guys weren't instigating any sort of conflict.
We were always defending. I mean, we were always on the defense. The Secretary of State will go somewhere and make some comment, and it's just we weren't pushing or initiating any aggression. Aggression came from them who wanted to control us and overthrow us, overthrow the reality of the revolution and turn back the gains, as you say in those times, turn back the gains of the revolution. So yes, it is not as if we were there and we waiting to go and invade a country, or we were just wanting to make sure that we defend ourselves, which we have a right to, and I think They went about it the wrong way. When I say they, I mean the invaders, in terms of trying to bring a split between the government itself. The old saying, divide and rule to conquer, divide mm-hmm. and rule, and mm-hmm. the propaganda and all the things that they put out, really contributed towards this malaise that we now have. Because people, as I said earlier on, people are still reeling from the experience. People died, and we'll come to that in a little while. There were massive killings, etc. And reconciliation never took place in any genuine way. So it is, for me, a very bitter pill. At that time, when the revolution was in motion, my contribution was in the academics, education. I was responsible for academic education for the army. Was one of the coordinators for academic education, and to show that we were serious in what we were doing. Lots of young people responded to coming into the army, of course. Well, I would say it's a noble thing to be in an army, a real army. And but the reality was that they were not academically prepared. Most of these guys left school and just there So they took the opportunity to listen, this is an opportunity, let me go and participate in my country's progress and development. So my engagement, my part in this was to, I was assigned to one of the army camps and to be responsible for lifting the academic standard of the soldiers, all soldiers, not just the privates. It was a case where every single member of that camp that I was part of attended classes on a daily basis to improve their academic standard so that they can be decent and progressive human beings. You have to be able to know things. You have to be able to understand things. You have to be able to interpret things, especially in a world at that time, it was very fierce. The East versus the West, and all these things were taking place. So you had to have a kind of academic background. One of the things that happened also is that there was quite a number of political education. So we explain things to people. When you see these things happening, you get a sense of what it means and so on. So people became knowledgeable. People became sharp in dealing with world issues, global issues, and so on. So it was a time when people developed. So I'm saying that I understood my role was inside to build that arm of the nation where soldiers don't just have to learn how to use guns, but they should know as well how to conduct a good conversation, be up to date with history, understand where we at. So it was more academic. And I think it was a very nice experience for me. I know it was a very nice experience for me to be able to be there to help these guys. And in fact, just a few weeks ago on the 25th, I had a forum where I talked about my experience during the last days. And I pointed out that it was so important that, we as a people don't just settle for anything lower than what we are capable of. And so being involved at the revolution, being involved at that level, I still do feel proud. And in fact, recently, up to now, there are guys who, of course, would have grown and become adults and so on, in so many ways, are still meeting me and saying that, Mr. Koi, thank you very much for those days, because they can now use those that kind of training going forward. So, yeah, I think it was a very good experience where you can watch not only people's lives grow, but you can watch your country develop to a level where you want it to be. I mean, having lived through the fact that there are so many wrong things that were taking place, there were disappearances of people. In fact, I do have an uncle up to this very present day. Uncle, he married to my aunt. Up to this very present day, we do not know where his body is.
And he disappeared during the invasion?
No, before.
Oh, before the invasion.
Yeah, and it has been alleged that Gary and his men are responsible because. Mm-hmm. He had a confrontation. He opposed Gary on some issues, and it disappeared. I mean, that for me is a bit appealing because I was one of the last family member he spoke with. I don't know if you know, but Karakou is a small island off Grenada, and actually that's where I'm from, and that's where we were. So, and he was in Grenada as a senior police officer. Mm-hmm. And one of those times when I came home from studies, because I did some studies in Trinidad, that's not too far from Grenada where I went to school. I would come home. I was around the Christmas time. I come home, and every time I come home, I'll go and see him because we're close, family ties. And I recall one of the times, that last time actually, he said to me, something is unright. Something is unright. Just feel that something is Is that right? Because of course he opposed, and I said he opposed, not just he took a stand and said, listen, I'm not going to get myself involved in any kind of corrupt things. I will stand up. So he told me, gave me things to bring home. That's now mainland Grenada, where I was. And I'm coming home now to Little Island off. And that was the last time we heard about him. We saw him. So you could understand how close that is to me. And the family, all the families, he had about 8 children. And all of us now are still, you know, reeling, trying to understand. Well, I mean, even though he died, yes, but let us know. Let's have a, you know, some kind of closure.
But yeah.
These things are still there, and it is because of the atrocities that was being taken place by the Greater United Labour Party, and that's the name of the government at the time. That's Gary's party and government, the Grenada United Labour Party. You know, all these things happened. And but the thing, Jason, I think is very, very important also is that the people who went through the revolution, lived through it, there were those who in the community were trained, and there's a group that we called pioneers, were the very little ones. You know, we still have those things on our minds, and we're still seeking to get reconciliation. I said a while ago that people died. Yes, so let me go now into what happened in October. After all what happened, the Americans were able to penetrate. People were able to spies, etc. And the split, and there was a definite split within the government. You know, people just started to give up. And it was a split that was created by the U.S., in my view, and the U.S. took advantage of it. And so in October, there was this sides where it was felt that Maurice Bishop was not fulfilling the role as he ought to, because this is a revolution, not just an ordinary time, but a revolution where we all have to be serious. And it was felt that he was not up to that. He was not, you know, in taking that seriously. And so many things were happening. People were being accused of all kinds of things like that. So, and you know, that is an easy way to invade when you have these kind of things happening. So in October, the split, Morris resisted. The army, of course, was placed him under house arrest for defying. You know, in a revolution, you had that's what happened. So he defied and he resisted, and the army at that time was split in two: some on that side and some on this side. They had him under house arrest, and so, you know, the Americans, we believe, used the opportunity to come in, and a massive demonstration, public demonstration, went and free him. Of course, we're dealing with an army. And I'm still up to today just trying to understand. And after you're accusing anybody, but trying to understand why Morris, who is such an important, knowledgeable, and well-respected internationalist, would want to lead a crowd of people up on the army headquarters. You know, I mean, in any part of the world you go, I mean, the headquarters of the army is out of bounds. So, having been left, having been released by the people, and I would like to add here, assisted by outside forces, he was led up to the fort. And his people who went up there, you know, went and took control of the army. The ammunition, and started to just give out to people. you know, give out to people, anybody who was around. And when that was observed and seen, you know, they had to bring some order, and they rearrested them. And there were gunfires exchanged. People had to scamper for their lives, some lost limbs and so on. And a few died. And it was that time, on October 19th, when the army and its leadership decided that it was a violation. And in a revolution, those things don't happen. So they tried Morris and some other cabinet colleagues who were supportive. They lined them up against the Fort Wall, while on the fort, and shot them as part of the punishment for creating what they considered to be that going contrary to the rules and values of the revolution. So on October 19th, that happened. And the country was under house arrest as well. People couldn't come out, and it was chaos. The prime minister and several of his men died. And that was the prelude for the invasion. The leadership, the Americans joined together with other regional forces because they didn't want it to appear as though they were the ones who really, really wanted this collapse, brought in some other regional people. And so they came to the island and turned things around. Of course, by that time, you must know that, remember that Morris and seven others died. So that happened. Bitter as it is, it happened. And I don't think I want to ever witness that again. And so 7 days afterward, on the 25th, the 19th, yes, yes, the 25th, the first American soldiers landed along with regional support. And that's where the journey is. They came in, arrested lots of us who were involved.
You got arrested too, Mr. Coy? You got arrested too?
Yes, I was picked up, you know, as someone who was involved. And I did explain the level of involvement. But at that time, they didn't want to know who was doing what, who was a cleaner, who was a, you know, once you were. And so, yes, I spent 7 days, what I recall, in defense, where they used the same incomplete airport to make some barbed wire fence and put all of us who they considered to be, you know, the culprits or the reasons why, and so on. It was an experience that I shared, with the audience here. That for me, those last days meant a lot. I understand a lot of things, and of course, I've been talking about the lessons that we can learn from that situation. So they came, and on 25th, and they're still here, no sign of saying, "Well, thank you, we have accomplished our goals, and we can now leave." They came, and of course, they had to get rid of the entire concept of the revolution. Not just the people, but even the concept of our revolutionary people who understood that we have to stand up for our rights. For example, all the books that were created, what were done in terms of the academics, strangely, and I think it might be a shame for me to be saying that in Grenada, but they came and the education system actually went in a reverse. They burnt books that were labeled or used by the revolution because they wanted to get rid of
them. They burnt books?
Burnt books. And I'm saying that.
Wow.
Sure, that is an indictment as far as I'm concerned for the country. But they wanted to get rid not just of the prime minister, of the leaders, but they wanted to get rid of the concept of the revolution. Because one of the things that the revolution did was it exposed a lot of people like myself to writing and to produce books and to understand. And to, so there were several books written in our language so that we can or people can understand. And, that, and those books were used as the teaching template, you know, basically. So that was dread to me, that they would have burnt books and destroyed all the things that were, anything that had the symbol of the revolution in it were destroyed because, I mean, of course, you know, you just want to keep us in bondage, lack of knowledge, want us to just toe your line and, to, and so on. But yeah, so it was horrific. Not only in the scene lives lost, but in the scene the extent in which you'll go to crush a people who want to develop themselves, who want to, you know, who want to be free. Because freedom was something around, if you can recall, I don't know, but around that time too, there was a lot of talk about freedom, freedom fighters and so on. People wanted to be liberated from the colonial hang-ups and so on. So it was that kind of harsh. And I still, up to today, still think that it was wrong to have done that kind of thing to our people. Bruise them, batter them, and of course, you know, take away the means of education. I think it was just horrible.
So in the aftermath of all this, and the story that gets told over here is that a big reason for the invasion was because there was some, like, a handful of students there. We were freeing some students.
Oh, well, that's one of the things that they used. They have there's a medical university here, a medical school here. That was that Gary brought. In fact, it was good. Not everything he did that was wrong, but I'm just saying that that was good. And so it created an opportunity for students around the world to come here and get into medicine. So they've been present here and was used as a pretext. Oh, we have some students. The students say, come and get us because we're in trouble, we're in danger. And so they come on that pretext. But of course, as we all know, that was just a means used. They always find some way to do what madness they want to do. And not only them, but of course, big powers. They always find some reasons. So yes, so they came. But the students, I recall, said, in fact, the faculty at the school said they weren't in danger. And those who were in charge at that time said the students are safe. Nothing will happen. But well, of course, they don't want to hear that. They want to know that they can have a justifiable reason to come. And so we come to rescue our students. But they came to rescue our students. And in my view now that they rescued the students, no, okay, right. You don't have to stay. You know, you have to stay and change things around and create a new world of experience. You know, so yes, so the Americans used the fact that students were on the island as one of the reasons, as the main reasons, to come and rescue the people. But time will tell, as time showed, it wasn't them alone. They came and they're still here. They are still here. And that I want the world to know, that they are still here doing all kinds of things, you know, making us feel as though we're second class citizens, you know, there's a wrong direction, just a wrong direction. And I think that, you know, there are so many things, more things that we can talk about. And in fact, I want us to go into that some more. And, because the aftermath, after the invasion, they arrested us and they had no to try them. Trial, because of course people died, so they had a trial, and that took a few years. I was a journalist then. Even when I was being part of the academic education, of course I used to write a lot. But when the collapse, I went into full time journalism, and I wrote, so I was able to cover the trial, and I want to speak about the trial on a separate cast. Because it is so interesting, that the trial, and I must say, the guys, the 17 who they eventually hold accountable, did not participate in the trial, and probably when we talk about that, I can explain why. Didn't participate, and they, you know, just did their own thing. You all go ahead and just do what you do. Try them, and at the end of it, they find them guilty, and charge them, and the sentence was death by hanging. You know, so we were going to experience a massive death, a slaughter rather, of people who they consider, who they feel that, you know, was has done wrong, etc. And it was a government that came in afterward, headed by Sir Nicholas Braffitt. He really, in fact, I recall, he died now some years ago. I can recall him speaking. He's also from Kiaraku, and we are close, you know, that kind of thing. I recall him saying to me one day, I cannot take to oversee the fact that 17 people are going to be harmed under my watch. So it was a terrible thing. So, you know, with a lot of advocacy and so on, he commuted the death sentence to life imprisonment. And that's how they escaped death, really. You know? And so, as I said, we'll talk about that aspect of things. Really, so the hanging did not take place. And because their life were committed life in imprisonment, it means that the life span came to an end. You know, these guys spent some 29 or 28 years in prison, you know. You know? And so they were able to be released based on laws that says, you know, if you spend all this time, you can be. But as I said, I would like us to do it a separate thing, the trial, because it's very, very important. I mean, you might want to go and check and see reports and see what the trial was.
I mean, if you're down, we can do a whole series and you can come back on as many times as you like.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, to you at the start, probably before we started to record, that I am down for sharing. I think that a lot of people, and I realize how important it is to share, and things I might take for granted that I know. A lot of people, a lot of Grenadians, a lot of people went away. Wow, you know, when I explained to them the reality of the situation, you know, how I was dragged on the ground, and put in, and you know, all kind of ways and so on and so forth. They did not understand that. They just, all they keep hearing was that, oh, you know, the Russian collapsed and they were doing all kind of things there and the Americans came. And there's always a controversy. And it was interesting to hear how you describe this. There are still people in Grenada who are saying it was an intervention. I say,
wow,
it's an invasion. Our island was invaded. Nobody I'm saying that from my own perspective because of my own experience. There was not any intervention, but, you know, that's how they sold it as, and that's how they want to make people think that we intervened in a time when chaos, and I will repeat again, you know, they didn't want to set it up, in my view. I mean, you know, they wanted us to be, they wanted the revolution to end because they didn't like what happened. And they didn't like what was happening. And so they fought. Imagine they used to have training, practice. The U.S. and regional forces. And they would code name it Amber and the Grenadines. Amber and the Grenadines before the Grenada. You know, they'll code name it, practice how they would do it. So it was a practice. It wasn't anything by, oh, we open morning and we get a call, come and help us across there. It wasn't as that. It was the fact that they orchestrated this thing strategically, do all kind of things. And we have, and you see, I mean, even if I said it then, but now I'm seeing it because the evidence that I'm showing now is that they didn't care two hoots about us. All they wanted was to change the system and to have their influence.
Exactly.
So it's that kind of pressure.
And there was already some Western companies in Grenada taking the natural resources from the country, correct? I shouldn't say. Mining them, if you will. So your big export is spices and fish too, right?
Yeah, fishing. I mean, a lot of the cooperatives that we established, we have some good fishermen. I mean, people who have just been sent abroad to train and to get to know the modern technology in fishing. Cuba, one or the other Western Bloc country, I think it was, gave us a fleet of fishing trawlers. So we cannot feed ourselves. I mean, why couldn't they give us that? We're not able to feed ourselves because men, young people were trained and fishing and all aspects of fishing, not just go and catch fish, just throw a line and catch fish in an organized, professional, in a way that can sustain the livelihoods of our people. You know, it is. So I think, Jason, for me, the other part two is very, very important because I think it deals with the thereafter, the aftermath. And the aftermath continues all now. There were attempts to create a reconciliation because people died, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Moise died. His cabinet colleagues died. I'm not here taking sides, but the reality is people lost their lives. Brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, they lost lives. And it's not a matter of who you support or which side you're on. The fact that you are in mourning, I mean, you need to get some kind of compassionate. So there was a big shifting to do a reconciliation. They call it truth and reconciliation, patterned after what happened in South Africa. But the truth and reconciliation was not truthful enough. To bring an end to the pain and to the anguish and to all the pain and all the sufferings still existing. You know, people still suffering. People are still reeling. Where is my son? And so I think this aftermath is something that I will really want to take some time and specifically go into these areas, not just from a historical standpoint, but look at what has happened and what is happening. As we seek to understand the Grenada Revolution, then from then to now.
And as a, I'm sure you'd call yourself a revolutionary, moving forward, how can we reignite this flame, this revolutionary flame in a place like Grenada?
Well, I think it's not only in Grenada, but I think it's they have been able to conquer the western sides and different parts of the world. They have gone into countries. For example, you mentioned Nicaragua early on. Yes, they have just invaded places. And how can we flip it? I think one of the things that I have committed myself to do is to continue with education, educate people. I believe that knowledge is still power. The more we know, the stronger we're going to be. And if we teach our young people, a lot of young people don't know the history, other than what they were told, and by those who did not like the revolution in any case, so they won't speak nice about it. We can continue to educate. We can really and truly go out on a campaign to educate people about who they are. Why are we experiencing things that we are experiencing now? Put it in the context of global politics, etc. You know, so we can do it, and I want us to, you know, look at it. I would say from an objective way, because I mean, I'm not here taking sides. I'm looking at the facts. I mean, and I could speak on both sides. I know there were things that happened that shouldn't happen. Not understanding that, but I'm just saying that we need to be objective, open-minded, be truthful, and when we're wrong, where we are wrong, we say we're wrong. And we admit, and we decide to go forward. Going forward requires a lot of awareness, one, education, and, I'm doing some writing myself because, you know, the books that are available tells it from their side of the story. Their side.
That they do.
I recall one of the experiences I had because of my involvement was even before the Americans came and the airports were closed. Nobody could have come in. One journalist I know found his way into Kikaraku, and I was asked to, you know, monitor, follow him, and, you know, be there just to see what his intention. Of course, you know, your country is about to be invaded, so you're in that state of mind. So I followed the instructions, and I said, okay, let me see what you're up to. But he was able to tell me on the 19th. I think he came on the 15th or so. He was able to say on the 19th, soldiers are going to be coming. You know, so we were aware that at least not, it wasn't just talk about an invasion, but actual fact they were coming. So I'm saying this to say also that knowledge, information, I believe that's the way we have to go in saving probably a generation or two. But knowledge, information, do not be misled, and do not be fooled by what others are going to be saying. The point is we need to sit down and understand and learn the lessons. And I probably will end this part of it by talking about the lessons that we need to learn.
What's the biggest lesson you think we need to learn from all this?
That we need to see our value as one people. We need to see our value not just as me fighting in a corner, you fighting in that side, but we need to see our value as a people. One of the things that Revolution taught was nationhood. Nationhood. There was pride in being a Grenadian. There was pride in being a human being, because you feel as though you are valuable. You know, and I think one of the lessons that we need to learn and come back again to it is the fact that we are we to take pride as a nation. There was quite a lot of solidarity. I learned that well. That's solidarity. We called each other comrade, mm-hmm. You know, Comrade Morris, Comrade Coy. And comrade means something. I mean, it will mean for you, mister. But our salutation was that we understood that we are bonded together. And so a lesson is learned. I learned that the value and importance of camaraderie, of being in solidarity. And from that standpoint also, not only solidarity with individuals, but solidarity with countries. There were a lot of countries who were in solidarity with us and what we were doing, even our struggles. So the lessons are, or I know we are, and understand the value and importance of our camaraderie. And our solidarity to each other so that we can work together. I think if we understood stood that, even though we had differences in the party then, it could have been resolved. I see no reason why it could not have been resolved. But I guess people had their own agendas and influenced by others. I think that it went the way it went. But I'm still learning. that it's important that we have that kind of camaraderie relationship. We look out for each other's back. We don't sell each other to the highest bidder. And, you know, we build together, not build trying to mash up and break down. Build together so that we can continue to experience more healthcare that we need. We can continue to experience a higher level of education, you know. And we can continue to be people who would work together to feed ourselves. Grow what you eat and eat what you grow was the slogan. And people love to do it. Of course, yes. Who wouldn't like to be sustained by our own efforts, through our own efforts and through the value of coming together other people? So these are just some of the lessons I've learned and I'm appreciating in going forward, that we need to, despite our differences. I learn also that we're going to always have, there will always be differences, always. there will. So we have to know as adults, as macho people, find a way to deal with those issues. Can't just because we don't agree with somebody, just take a gun and shoot. You know, we have to understand that there is need for coming together, understanding we will have differences. It's a must, as far as I'm concerned. Because that's how we would ruffle and you know, gauge ourselves and stand, you know, and make sure that we are on good footing. When we engage others, it may be different views to us. I mean, even now I speak to people. I mean, I know they have their own views, but that doesn't give me the right to say, well, you know, write you off. Let's talk. I might learn something from you that I didn't see. Or you can learn something from me because you were not there. But when we are stuck with this kind of propaganda thing, I think it's not contributing to healing, to reconciliation. It is not good for us. So the lessons I have learned and will continue to promote that is we need a better understanding of who we are, and we need to also understand the reality of bonding together as a people. Despite our differences, we can still help and support each other.
And you're still reporting, you're still a journalist?
Yes, I'm still. In fact, I do have, I had several years of experience. My experience in journalism direct is some 35 years now. I have been able to maintain that passion I have for writing and reporting. Basically, I've had some training in the U.S. several years ago. It was 89, 90. You know, I had some training there. I had a fellowship. I still write. One time I was a freelance writer for regional papers. But understanding my advocacy role, and you know, people in this time, people would not want to give you the opportunity to speak, or they want to tell you what to say when you speak. I have been able to develop my own media platform, and I want you to check it out when you get a chance. Is www.conceptionnewsnetwork.com. So it's Conception News Network. And that's an area in which I want to use as a platform to educate people. It's my advocacy portal where I deal with issues, you know, of advocacy, empowerment, and civil society issues and NGOs. Just this morning, I had an interview with someone dealing with civil society organizations. That's where I want to be. So I continue to write. I continue to train people in writing, because I also have been able to develop an institute, a media training institute, where people who want to get involved, be introduced to the media, this is like a entry point. So I have that, I've been doing that for like a while. There are people who are knowing the media who came through that medium, you know, and we will continue to support knowledge sharing. I will continue to empower people so that they can be stronger despite whatever challenges we may face. So I think that's one of the ways in which we can really get this generation and the future ones to get a deeper insight as to what this what the experience of the revolution was like. I mean, there are so many things that we still have to learn in life, but I think we need to understand that we are all part in this together. When you up there in the U.S., your cry is my cry. Yeah, our African brothers, their cries are my cries. You know, their pain is my pain. So yes, we need to understand that we are of the same ilk, from the same yard, as I would say. Play in the same yard, so we know each other well, and we can relate to each other in that positive way.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today, and I look forward to us having many, many more of these conversations. I'm always down to speak to you, and now that Mary has connected us, I'm excited, and I may annoy you, so I'm letting you know up front, I may annoy you with questions and requests to come on the show and all kinds of other stuff, so I'm letting you know up front.
You will not annoy me at all. This is my life now. Sharing, because I believe knowledge is indeed power. I'm not just saying it as a slogan. Knowledge is indeed power. And I think I want my people, all people, to have that knowledge and that understanding that we are in this together and we will stand up with each other and make it happen. Yeah, so not at all, not annoying me. In fact, call me anytime. Mary is there. Mary and I are now partners. You can reach out to her, and she's doing a wonderful job in terms of setting these things up for me. Just a couple of weeks ago, days ago, actually, I think it was, I had an interview with someone in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
And she was able to set that up. She knew the people there, and it was great. But they are also asking us to continue. So we want to share it to the world. The world needs to know this is where we are. This is the struggles we have gone through. And this is how we intend to go forward. And we want to deeply assure us that we're going to make it. We're going to make it.
Well, he is award-winning journalist and activist, Milton J. Coy. Mr. Coy, I'm going to play some music. Don't hang up. That was hella fun. I shouldn't say fun. That was hella cool. I am very interested, as you could probably tell from the show, on the history of the revolutionary movement in Grenada. To be able to uplift so many people out of poverty, to be able to educate so many people in such a short time, it's inspirational for me. And I think it's a very important story for a lot of us to hear here in the States, not just for the inspirational side of things, but more so we can understand what the heavy hand of American imperialism looks like. So thank you again, Mr. Coy, for coming on the show. He did say he was down to come on the live stream. If you guys aren't checking the live stream, you got to check the live stream. every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific time on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Twitch. We stream the show and we take your questions from all platforms. So any questions or comments, we definitely read them and put them up on air. And you are a part of the conversation. I really dig it. It's a little more looser than the show because some of you guys are rather silly, and some people on there definitely personally know me, so they know my silly side and know what makes me laugh. My mom likes to come on there and give me a hard time. That's always fun. So check out the live streams. Also, if you feel so inclined, become a patron. This show is growing and it's listener supported. We are creating some patron only programming. So if you would like to continue to see the show grow, we would appreciate it and become a patron. You get bonus content. We are creating the new animated series, Revolutionary Histories, which as I stop recording this, I will be doing my voiceover for the first history of China. We're going to see how that sounds and works. I'm very, very excited. Like, I'm like giddy. The excitement, I'm so giddy that we're doing this. And the people that have signed on to be part of it, it's making me even more giddy. And the histories that we'll be telling. So we're not just doing the history of the rise of China, but it's going to be kind of an in-depth, probably about 5-part series on China. Then we're going to do the Cuban Revolution and Castro, the Bolivarian Revolution, and Hugo Chavez, Silicon Valley, and the inherent monopolies in capitalism with Rob Larson, who wrote Capitalism and Freedom and Bit Tyrants, Dr. Asatar Baer. We talked about doing a show about the history of the Soviet Union, the rise and the fall, and what can we learn from that. And these are all going to be animated. How fucking cool is that? So, all right, I'll see you guys, or listen to you guys. You see you guys? I'll just holler at you guys later. Peace.